Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Outlaw Bonnie and Clyde died in a hail of bullets in 1934. The flesh and blood story of the out-of-work waitress and her prison-hardened lover who shot their way across the country has inspired movies, music, and more. 75 years later, a new biography takes a fresh look at the lives behind the legend. This hour On Point, finding the real Bonnie and Clyde. You can join the conversation. What is it about the story of Bonnie and Clyde that we find so seductive, so gruesomely appealing? What does their story tell us about America in the Great Depression? Joining me now from Tampa, Florida, is Paul Schneider. His new book is Bonnie and Clyde, The Lives Behind the Legend. It's getting rave reviews, and you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Paul Schneider, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Glad to be here.
Thanks. These iconic American gangsters, their rampage across the country, it's the stuff of myth and legend. What's the intrigue with Bonnie and Clyde, do you think?
Oh, well, I think what makes them such an iconic story and the kind of American story that's going to be told, you know, over and over again as long as we're telling stories is ultimately they're kind of a Romeo and Juliet, and you kind of don't know whether to think that they're fools or they're romantic heroes. You know, when you spend as much time with them as I did, you know, you alternate between feeling really sorry for them and thinking, you know, I'm really glad that I never have to run into either of these people in real life.
Give us a snapshot of Clyde.
Wow. Well, Clyde, the first thing that kind of surprises, I think, anybody who starts to look into the real Bonnie and Clyde as opposed to the various movie images is they were both physically very small people. Clyde was, you know, an inch or two over 5 foot tall, and Bonnie was under 5 feet, and they were small and slight. And I think that without putting too much into it, I think that really weighed on Clyde's self-image. He once even said to one of his gang members, one of his pals, who asked him, "Why are all these people starting to get shot? You know, we used to just go knock off you know, stores and steal safes, and nobody was getting killed." And he said, "Well, these cops don't realize I'm not a kid. You know, and I point a gun at them. If they wouldn't shoot, I wouldn't have to shoot them." So that's sort of one little snapshot of him. He also developed a kind of incredible hatred for the law and the prison system, both of which he felt had not treated him fairly. So he was determined after his experiences in the Texas prison system and his experiences briefly trying to go straight that he was never going to be caught alive. And the third thing I would say about him is he was more interested in guns and freedom than he was necessarily in accumulating big piles of cash and living high off the hog.
Because he wasn't a really great or even successful bank robber or criminal. He really had to shoot his way out of a lot of situations and rely on his superior driving abilities to escape many times.
Yeah, that is certainly an accurate description of him. He, you know, they had a couple of successful bank robberies, but they were usually done with a number of other gang members. I mean, it's hard once they're down to just mostly Bonnie and Clyde and one or two other people. It's not as simple thing to pull off a bank job even back in those days. But you're correct that there are more or as many cases of botched jobs. What he was superlative at was shooting his way out of trouble and driving his way out of trouble and having a nose for when trouble is about to start and staying cool under fire.
So the other half of the Bonnie and Clyde couple, Bonnie Parker, give us a snapshot of her.
You know, Bonnie is fascinating. She is, you know, on the one hand, clearly the more conventionally intelligent of the pair. She has aspirations to write poetry. She did very well in school, won the spelling bees when she was a child. She has this sort of a level of spunk that her mother describes from a very early age, kind of, you know, flirty and goofball-y in the school, in all the school plays. And yet she obviously, I guess, out of her love, you know, makes what appear to be incredibly foolish decisions to repeatedly get back together with the guy who turns out to be, you know, at least in terms of her life, the wrong guy, because it results in her death at the end.
She was madly in love with Clyde, isn't that right? And that's an interesting part of the story that I actually didn't expect.
Yeah, I would say for me that was another sort of surprise. Although there's two things I would say about that. They were instantly in love. Everybody says as soon as they met they were madly in love. But it was not her only love. She had been married actually previously to meeting Clyde, to another guy who wound up actually in jail, wound up dying in a prison break, many after Bonnie and Clyde were already dead, and he also had other loves. And during the period when Clyde is in jail, which is shortly after they meet, Bonnie sort of starts to see other people. But as their love progresses, and as they are on the road and on the run, they become completely reliant and loyal to each other, to the point where, in the end, Clyde is telling Bonnie, you know, you can turn yourself in. You won't be electrocuted. You won't be executed. They'll kill me. Go ahead. Go turn yourself in. And she refuses to do it.
Bonnie and Clyde, of course, as you mentioned, immortalized in the 1967 film starring Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty. I have a clip from that movie. Here they are soon after Bonnie and Clyde meet. They find that they've got some of the same hopes and dreams.
You can find a lover boy on every damn corner in town. It don't make a damn to them whether you're waiting on tables or picking cotton, but it does make a damn to me.
Why?
Why? What you mean, why? Because you're different, that's why. You know, you're like me. You want different things. You got something better than being a waitress. You and me traveling together, we could cut a path clean across this state and Kansas and Missouri and Oklahoma, and everybody'd know about it. You listen to me, Miss Bonnie Parker. You listen to me. Now, how would you like to go walking in the dining room of the Dolphus Hotel in Dallas wearing a nice silk dress and have everybody waiting on you? Do you like that? Does that seem like a lot to ask? That ain't enough for you. You got a right to that.
Hey, when did you figure all that up?
The minute I saw you.
How'd these two find each other, Bonnie
That's
and Clyde?
That's a good quote. They met actually at through a friend of a friend, the way, you know, a lot of 19, 20-year-olds meet each other. Bonnie had a string of jobs they knew a lot of people in common. It's, in some ways, it's surprising they hadn't met sooner. They both lived in West Dallas, which was sort of across the river and kind of the down and out side of town where you would end up if you couldn't afford to make it over into Dallas proper. And she had a string of jobs, waitressing jobs primarily, and those fell through in the Depression. And then she got a job kind of taking care of a friend of hers who had a broken leg and helping, you know, the other girl's father hired her. And Clyde just came over one day as sort of a friend visiting the hurt girl, and Clyde and Bonnie, he made him hot chocolate, and Clyde and Bonnie just fell in love right there, right then and there. So they met just sort of through circumstances. But Clyde would have known, they knew a lot of people in common because they lived in this same little sort of vaguely criminal, shady side of town.
Yeah, and the way they lived is so interesting, as you tell it in your book. I'm looking at a picture of the two of them down in a little ravine. Bonnie says, we lived in ravines, secluded woods, downside roads for days at a time, stretched into weeks. These two were all of 21 and 22 years old, living completely on the run in stolen cars and these odd places, and you tell the very funny story of how they both really were family folks, and they liked to have their favorite beans and cornbread.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it reminded them of a little bit of home, no?
Yeah. Well, and the beans and cornbread also sort of was the I love that picture, by the way, that you mentioned. That's probably my favorite picture of them. I mean, there's a lot of once you sort of know Bonnie and Clyde, or Clyde and Bonnie, as they were called by most of their contemporaries, and you start to look at that picture, you can see the details. I mean, he's actually more obsessed with cleaning his gun, and yeah. You know, and it's also probably the only real candid shot. It was taken by their friend Floyd Hamilton. Who was sometimes a compatriot and sometimes a go-between them and their family. But, yeah, the making beans was a code also, because Bonnie's mother and Clyde's mother were often on the telephone, and they knew the phone was being bugged by the Dallas police. So whenever they were going to have a meeting with Clyde and Bonnie, who would come back into town periodically to see, you know, to see their families, they were both completely family driven people, perhaps more than they would have been had they had real lives. But when they're out on the road, as they were in those last years, Mrs. Parker would say, you know, are you making beans? And Mrs. Barrow would say, yeah, we're going to have beans tonight. And that meant, you know, that they were the couple were coming home. The kids, they called them.
Lord, we never saw them coming till they read us both our rights. Disappointing ending for this modern day Bonnie and Clyde.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about outlaw lovers and robbers, Bonnie and Clyde. My guest this hour is Paul Schneider. His new book is terrific. It's called Bonnie and Clyde, The Lives Behind the Legend. I want to go to the phones now, get some callers into this conversation. Beth is first up in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Beth. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you. I ironically was writing a poem this week. I'm in an MFA program and I'm interested in Bonnie. I was writing about her, and so I'd like to know if, from your studies, what you can tell me about why you think she took the route that she did, because apparently she was an honor student, and you know she was interested in creative writing and had that going for her, but was it the time, because she was a woman and didn't have many options? Or, you know, just that he was so fantastic? Or what made her kind of go from, you know, an obedient student to bad girl? And along with that, I know one of her poems was Suicide Sal or something like that. I don't think she was suicidal, but she clearly knew what was going to happen. The road that they were on was going to end badly, and she was so young.
Beth, thanks. First, the question about the transformation from honor roll good girl to bad girl.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's a great question because that's sort of, you know, as we were sort of saying earlier, in a way, that's what makes them or makes Bonnie in particular continue to be interesting no matter how many times you look at her is, you know, how did she make these decisions? I think there's a couple of answers to that. I think one of them is very clearly love. She did feel when Clyde is sent off to prison shortly after Bonnie meets him, he's sent away for about 2 years, and Bonnie begins to see somebody else or one or two other people. At first she's writing Clyde letters that are sort of flirty about all these guys who are coming her way, and some of them are actually seem to be lawmen or deputies. I mean, she sort of lived in this world where she knew all the deputies and knew all the crooks. But as soon as Clyde comes back, according to the version Bonnie's mother told, she's with this other fellow, and Clyde just walks in the door. He's gotten together with his sisters and gotten himself a nice new suit, and he's all dolled up, and he's, honey, I'm home from prison, and she just drops the other guy like a hot potato. So there certainly was a personal love between the two of them. I think that, you know, she had a couple of jobs. As far as the depression and whether as a woman She was caught more than the men in that incredibly difficult economic time. Obviously, there were opportunities that weren't open to her. But whether that was in fact a reason for her to choose the life on the run and the life on the road is hard to say. I think she, even before the Depression, she seemed to pick the wrong kind of guys. Her first husband, as I mentioned, was also a burglar. So I don't really think that the economic circumstances drove her to it any more than they might have. And the other half of the question, I can't remember?
Her suicide poems that she perhaps knew what was coming.
Yeah, that poem's really interesting, the Suicide Sal poem, which is really the only – there's really only two complete poems that are attributed to Bonnie. And she wrote that one during the brief period when she was in jail. And Clyde had actually sort of abandoned her or had run off from – they both got caught and were in a position of being almost captured by the police. And Clyde decides to make a run for it and leaves her behind with his friend Ralph Fultz. And Ralph and Bonnie are caught and then sent to prison. And she's in prison when she writes that poem. And the story of that poem is about a woman who's in prison and whose lover is out running around with other guys. And she comes out and kills the lover who's running around. As for her own, I don't know that there's any real evidence that she had suicidal tendencies of her own. But you're entirely correct that she saw the writing on the wall. They both did. I mean, they very explicitly said, it's death for us. There's no other option.
The caller also mentioned Bonnie's poetry. You also have an excerpt of another poem, The Trail's End, which I wish you would read to us.
Yeah, I do have this little excerpt from that poem, which is her most famous one, and it's the story of Bonnie and Clyde. But why I just sort of set it up, I say one interesting thing is that everybody back at the time, they were more known as Clyde and Bonnie. And even today, among sort of students of the story who live in Dallas or in Louisiana where they were killed, it's sort of not a badge of honor, but it's sort of a trait. You can tell those who are talking about the movie versus the real.
Who knows
their
stuff?
Say Clyde and Bonnie versus Bonnie and Clyde. But here we have Bonnie herself calling them Bonnie and Clyde. So she is the first, supposedly, who turned it around. But I'll read this short little excerpt. You've read the story of Jesse James, of how he lived and died. If you're still in need of something to read, here's the story of Bonnie and Clyde. Now, Bonnie and Clyde are the Barrow Gang. I'm sure you all have read how they rob and steal, and those who squeal are usually found dying or dead. There's lots of untruths to these write-ups. They're not as ruthless as that. Their nature is raw. They hate all the law, the stool pigeons, spotters, and rats. They call them cold-blooded killers. They say they are heartless and mean. But I say this with pride, that I once knew Clyde when he was honest and upright and clean. But the law fooled around, kept taking him down and locking him up in a cell, till he said to me, I'll never be free, so I'll meet a few of them in hell. The road was so dimly lighted, there were no highway signs to guide. But they made up their minds. If all roads were blind, they wouldn't give up till they died. The road gets dimmer and dimmer. Sometimes you can hardly see. But it's fight man to man and do all you can, for they know they can never be free. From heartbreak, some people have suffered. From weariness, some people have died. But take it all in all, our troubles are small till we get like Bonnie and Clyde. If a policeman is killed in Dallas and they have no clue or guide, if they can't find a fiend, they just wipe their slate clean and hang it on Bonnie and Clyde. That's a great selection from that poem that you chose because it really does capture the way they perceived their predicament, which was that the police were not going to give them a fair shake and that if they had turned themselves in, they were going to be killed anyway. Clyde very explicitly says, I'm not going in because there's a death penalty.
And he knew if he'd be caught, he would face the chair.
Yeah.
There's great debate about whether Bonnie actually pulled the trigger. And I know her family went to great lengths to say that she never killed anybody. Did she?
it's unlikely that she actually killed anybody. And it's very likely that she did pull the trigger in some of the shootouts. If she killed somebody, it was not, I wouldn't say by accident she was pulling the trigger, but it would have been at Joplin where she was seen shooting out of the window and where two people died. But it's much more likely that she was not the killer in either of those. But the idea that she never actually shot is also untenable. There's plenty of – there's several witnesses both there at Joplin, and which was a big shootout in a little apartment they rented in Missouri, and on the road fleeing from a couple of botched bank jobs where they kind of, you know, squeal out of town with guns blazing. And yes. Clyde was driving, and she and Blanche were seen shooting out the back.
We'll talk about Blanche, because that's an interesting side note here. Bonnie and Clyde often brought in their extended family into their capers, didn't they?
Yeah, Blanche and Buck, in some ways, you know, in some ways, Blanche is perhaps the most tragic of them all, because she really got into the gang against her will, because she was equally in love with Clyde's brother Buck as Bonnie was with Clyde, and in some ways you might also say that Blanche may have been the smartest of the gang and Buck may have been the dumbest of the gang in some ways, but Clyde did bring Buck back in, and Buck had this idea that he could somehow get Clyde to go clean and turn himself in, which everybody else knew was impossible. And Blanche fights it, completely wanting to get together with Clyde and Bonnie. And Buck says, "Well, just give me, you know, a week or two, and I'll turn him around. And if it doesn't work, you know, we'll leave." And so they go to this little apartment they rent in Joplin, which is a kind of a honky tonk city at that point in southern Missouri that was known for kind of being welcoming to criminals and bootleggers and whatnot, and they have this little idyllic couple of weeks there where they're almost playing at being suburban. I mean, they're doing jigsaw puzzles and they're, you know, playing cards at night, and but they stay a day too long, and the police ultimately come knocking, thinking that they're bootleggers or thinking there's something strange about them, and there's this terrific shootout, and Buck. And at that point, everybody has to run out, and Buck and Blanche run out and leave behind sort of enough evidence, their marriage license, Buck's pardon from the governor of Texas, enough to show that they're with the gang. And from then on, they're pretty much – they don't have any choice either. So they're sort of captive, but they're not innocent by any stretch.
Here's another call now from Nancy. She's in Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to On Point. I appreciate you waiting.
Yes, I do appreciate. I remember on a very fine April day, and it was a fine, fine stretch of weather that spring, in 1968, seeing Bonnie and Clyde at Kenmore Square in Boston and coming out really unimpressed.
Oh, you didn't like it, huh? Why not? Yes. Why not, Nancy? Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Why didn't you like the movie?
I thought it was a complete idealization of two lowlifers who were rather quite worthless. Perhaps, as the program says, they were in love with each other, and that was about the extent of it. And to extend the metaphor, as a student of literature, Mad Magazine, and I'm not being facetious, had their own parody. They called it Balmy and Claude, and at the end, the authorities couldn't stand Bonnie's poetry anymore, and that's why they were shot up. And to extend the metaphor, the new couple on the screen is going to be Eva and Dolph, with the irresistible Estelle Parsnip. As
Yeah, Blanche.
That's right. Nancy, I love the memory, and I so appreciate your call, Paul. Balmy and Claude. I guess I actually read that in one of the clips for this interview. A lot of people saw that movie. It was well produced, and I guess it grossed a lot of money, $70 million.
Oh, well, and it was hugely controversial.
Immediately.
I disagree about the quality of the movie, although the question of whether they are romantic heroes or cold-blooded killers, it gets back to sort of what we were saying earlier about what makes them continue to be interesting, because they certainly were cold-blooded killers, Clyde anyway, 12 people or 11 or 12, depending on how you count it, ended up dead because he was unwilling to turn himself in or was unwilling to do what it takes. So you can't escape that they were actually criminals. But then, Romeo killed somebody before he meets Juliet. I mean, that's why he's on the run. So there is something about this kind of this sort of complicated criminal lover that does sort of resonate and that keeps them interesting. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that there were victims.
Paul Schneider, this is strictly nonfiction, your book. No dialogue or other material has been made up. You spent 3 years writing this book. How did you research it? You didn't read secondary sources, I understand, all of the other books about Bonnie and Clyde. How did you get your facts?
Well, I did read some secondary sources. I mean, one can't escape them, and there were some very good books and some secondary sources on other topics, on the Depression in general and on Prohibition and on Dallas and the development of Dallas and that sort of thing. But for me, what I discovered beginning when I began to write this book was that there was this incredible wealth of interviews, some of them in newspapers, some of them recorded, some of them in sort of early documentaries, some of them police interviews, some of them FBI sort of reports. There was this wealth of what we would call real primary source material, which isn't to say that all primary source material is true or untrue. Some of these, interviews are with people who were career criminals who made their living by living lies. So you have to take them at some sort of face value. But I realized that there was enough of this kind of material among people in the record of people who actually ran with Bonnie and Clyde or actually knew them or were victims or were at the scene of the crimes, to try to tell the story as much as possible in those voices. So I sort of set out in a way to almost write an oral history, if you will, of Bonnie and Clyde, keeping as much of it in the voices of these actual witnesses. And interestingly, just getting back to the movie for a second, one of the great things for me about the movie is that in 1968 and 69, after the movie, because it was so popular and so controversial, in all of these little towns all over Texas and the Midwest where I traveled, you could go to the library and I'd look in 1932, or 1933 for the coverage of the actual crime, the bank robbery or the shootout or whatever it was. And then sure enough, if you looked again in 1969 or 68, there would be a follow-up where the local town editors, when the movie came out, that would say, well, we have right here, the actual bank teller. Mm-hmm. So there was this whole other body of material from the 1960s that wouldn't have been available to a researcher today because the people would have passed away.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're taking a fresh look at Bonnie and Clyde this hour, 75 years after they went down in a hail of bullets. My guest this hour is Paul Schneider. His new book is Bonnie and Clyde, The Lives Behind the Legend. You can read an excerpt at our website at onpointradio.org, where we also have some of Bonnie's poems. Let's get straight to the phones. First, from Hendersonville, North Carolina, David is on the line. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane. Hello, Paul.
Hi.
Hi, David.
Welcome.
Yeah. Just a quick note. One is first thing in listening to your show today, the first thing that came up were banks.
Mm.
So I'm thinking about the period of time and the condition of banks at that point in time. The second thing that came up in my mind was the difference between this 21st century and that period of time, how people can move about and get away with the kinds of things that they got away with just because you could do that. Now in this day and age, that can't happen. So that's the second thing that I think about, the freedom they must have had to move about the way they did.
Hmm. It's a good question, David. Thank you. Paul, do you think Bonnie and Clyde would have gotten away with all this stuff today?
Not likely, no. I mean, in a sense, it's a really – well, they're both really good questions.
Mm-hmm.
But the mobility issue was really the secret to Bonnie and Clyde's success, if you can call managing to survive for a couple of years success. They – Clyde, in particular, was an extraordinary driver, and he practiced his driving. On back roads, he'd practice, reversing the car at top speed and then slamming on the brakes and spinning it around and putting it straight into second so that he could go, start right up down the road without ever having to lose his momentum in that direction. And he also scouted everything maniacally and would because he had been caught early on, he didn't do that, and he got, in a kind of Keystone Cops ridiculous screw up. He drove right back into the town that he and his buddies had burgled the night before, and the police were standing, and he got caught and ended up going to jail. So after that, he was obsessive about knowing every road, every back road, and he also knew that he could steal, because he stole cars and could just steal a new one when he needed a new one, he could steal the fastest car on the road, which was a Ford V8, and that the cops typically had, old clackety-bang Model A's or Model T's and were not in any position to follow him. And the other key thing was that they didn't have radios in the police cars at that point. So they were not able to radio ahead and set up if they wanted to stop and call ahead, they had to pull off the road and make a phone call. And by that time, if Clyde noticed them doing that, he would just change his course. He would often drive right off across fields as well. The cars in those days were made to be able to handle, all manner of roads. There wasn't as many paved roads as there are today. So he was also known for just setting off across the countryside to hit another road. And as for the banks –
Well, let me ask you about
that, Jane.
The banks, because I was interested, as the caller brought up, that in your research you noticed that the locals at that time actually grew tired of the killings of Bonnie and Clyde, but not necessarily of their bank robberies, which led me to the question of how did the culture of the day during this Great Depression period play into the creation of Bonnie and Clyde?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things to be said about that, and the banks is it's a very good question. One thing about the Depression, 5,000 banks closed pretty rapidly, and there was no bailout, so there were a lot of banks that were gone, and the ones that were in business were primarily taking people's farms away or taking people's houses away, and so they were highly resented, and so I don't think anybody got tired of Bonnie and Clyde robbing banks. They did get tired of them killing policemen and killing whoever else got in their way. And they weren't, they weren't altogether that successful at robbing banks. I mean, as we said earlier, they botched a couple of jobs. And Clyde really preferred small jobs that would get them enough money to stay on the road. But there is the story that's sort of in the movie and a couple of – and there's some dispute over whether it really happened to Clyde or whether it was really one of his buddies. But they did go into a bank and the guy the guy said, well, there's no money in this bank. This bank closed yesterday. and that's sort of one of their failed bank jobs. So there was I think, a lot of ambivalence among – the down and out anyway of the Great Depression about these banks and whether and who cared if they got robbed. And also insurance, deposit insurance had just been put in. So people knew that at least if they had a little money in the bank, it was safe.
Let's go out to New Mexico. Sky City, New Mexico. John is on the line. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Nice to be with you.
Thank you.
I'm appreciating the show very much.
Good. Thank you.
Hi, John.
Go ahead.
I would like to say I grew up in eastern Kansas and saw the movie when I was about 20 in Ann Arbor. And I, in contrast to the woman from Boston, I was very uplifted by it. It was like a combination of Robin Hood and pirates and living on the run and the electrifying banjo music. I thought it was a fantastic introduction into my life of these two characters, and I'm really fascinated by your book and your attempt to get to these people through interviews. I think it's all great. I think it captures kind of a little bit of that Western American spirit.
John, thank you. Paul, I'm interested to sort of cue off John's question. I'm interested into your research into the realities of the prison system in Texas at the time of Clyde's incarceration. What did you find when you looked into that? Is it related to their capers?
Well, that was a fascinating part of the book for me. And interestingly, we're kind of all interested in the banks because events have unfolded and now we're having a banking crisis. And so and it's funny how when you're writing a book that you think has nothing to do with anything right now, events can kind of come in on that. And in a sense, the prison thing, a similar kind of event happened, which is sort of right as I was setting off to research this, was when the whole country became involved in the question of torture and is torture American and how un-American it is to torture. And here in the Texas prison system, well into the 20th century, I discovered that, it was perfectly legal to hang prisoners from their wrists from the ceiling, or to make them stand on a barrel for 8 hours until they fell off and then put them up again, or to beat them with these Texas bat. And Clyde went into this system as a young man, 19 or 20, and was completely, was abused in that system, also by other prisoners in the ways that prisoners, particularly small-bodied males, are well known to become victims of bigger, stronger inmates. And in fact, his first murder probably took place in the Texas prison farm. And he came out. It was so bad that he cut part of his foot off to try to get transferred out of this prison farm. And he was not alone doing that. There were a lot of there was a wave of prisoners who mutilated themselves to try to get transferred back off these prison farms to the main jail. And so in a sense, it takes Clyde, who's already a bad operator, but not necessarily a vindictive, trigger-happy one, and hardens him into this person who is, determined never under any circumstances to get himself back into the prison system. That has to be tempered, however, by saying that there were obviously thousands of other men and women, but the prison he was in was men who went through those systems and did not come out on the other end and kill 12 people. So, it's not to say that it explains – it's not to say that it excuses who Clyde Barrow became. But in his own mind, it certainly explained it.
Let's go back to the phones. Mike is calling from Interstate 81 in Virginia. Hi, Mike. Glad you called. Thanks for waiting.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
I've heard shows similar to this before. And I heard a couple of different people, after their studies, say they found that Clyde was homosexual. I wonder if you uncovered anything like that.
Mm. All right, Mike. Thank you. Paul?
Thanks, Mike. That is one of the questions that often comes up. And certainly the movie portrays his sexuality as ambiguous. I have to say that there is really no evidence among contemporaries of his, nobody who knew him or that ran with him ever said that, and some of them explicitly denied it. He was raped in prison when he was young, but there really isn't any evidence of that that I could find. And in a sense, that it's I spent a fair amount of time trying to track down where the rumor started, and I expected sort of to find it actually in the FBI papers because the federals did sort of make an effort to discredit Bonnie and Clyde and to kind of, you know, you could call it educate the public to their true nature, or you could call it, you know, propagandize the public against them as these sort of Robin Hoodish characters. But the short answer is, I don't believe there's any evidence that Clyde was homosexual.
Let's go back to the phones. If we could go to Kevin. He is calling from Boston. Kevin, are you there?
I am. Hi, how are you?
Hi, welcome. Go ahead.
Hi, Paul. I just have a quick question about the fort, the dam that they were killed in. I understand that after they were shot and killed, a private entrepreneur put the car on a carnival circuit. I was wondering if you have any idea what happened to that car. Hmm.
Kevin, thanks.
Oh yeah, yeah. The car is out in Nevada, and because I didn't really. It was an early decision that I it was put on a circuit, and there were some sort of mock up. There were some whatever ersatz cars that also went around, but the real car is out at a casino in Nevada. And I didn't. The name of it escapes me. And because I sort of had to make a decision pretty early on in writing this book about whether to write about the legend of Bonnie and Clyde after they died, or to keep it very tightly to what I could find out about the real story. So I actually did not spend a lot of time researching the artifacts. They're also, interestingly enough, the prime exhibit at the Bonnie and Clyde Ambush Museum, which is a great little museum, actually, and the guys there are great and very helpful. And that's in Gibbsland, Louisiana. They have the movie car, which is, you know, almost as big an attraction as the real car. So that's what I can tell you. The car has definitely been earning income for whoever has owned it ever since the day Bonnie and Clyde died in it.
Speaking of that, would you tell us briefly about that famous last ambush of Bonnie and Clyde, Paul Schneider?
Yeah, the famous last ambush of Bonnie and Clyde, it happened, I would say, in my opinion, that the movie is relatively accurate about sort of how it happened, although neither Clyde nor Bonnie ever got out of the car. But they were, you might say, betrayed by a kid who was traveling with them, whom Clyde had sprung from jail during a raid on the old prison. A lot of Clyde's life can be seen once he got out of that horrible Texas prison was an attempt to go back and break out some of his friends. But this one person who was traveling with him, it was really more his parents who engineered a deal with the law to separate their son from Bonnie and Clyde and to tell the posse when Bonnie and Clyde would be coming back down this road in Louisiana. And there were six lawmen hidden in the woods there pretty much overnight waiting. And the boy's father was parked in a truck similar to the movie. And Clyde slowed down, because Clyde always drove at 100 and as fast as those V8s could go. And, you know, they could hear him coming. But he slowed down because he recognized the truck. And basically, they just let as many bullets fly into them as they could. There's no – some of the police later – some of the lawmen later, you know, said, oh, we gave him a chance to give up. But there's not really any evidence that they did. And in the defense, they would have been crazy to have tried to stop them. Because plenty of other 13 other people had tried to stop them and ended up dead. So it was essentially trial by fire, or, you know.
I only have about a minute left, Paul. And honestly, as I read the book, I was wondering whether we should be disgusted or sympathetic to Bonnie and Clyde. And I wonder what you think now about Bonnie and Clyde since you've written this book. How has your image of them changed, your thoughts about them?
It depends on when I'm thinking about them. I believe that is what makes Bonnie and Clyde live on in legend and be perennially interesting to readers. Hopefully, if Bonnie and Clyde Lies Behind the Legend, get my little pitch in there. But I think you have to ultimately come down on the side of disgust. I hate to say it. I mean, I think that because basically there are a dozen innocent people who ended up dead because of their run for freedom. And their run for freedom is noble, but the cost was pretty high.
Well, Paul Schneider, I appreciate your time this hour. The book is called Bonnie and Clyde, The Lives Behind the Legend. I love the read. Thanks so much for your time today. Good luck.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Acting upon reliable information, a federal deputation laid a deadly ambush when Bonnie and Clyde came walking in the sunshine.